Peterloo Massacre. From Wikipedia, the Free Encyclopedia, at en.wikipedia.org. The Peterloo Massacre, or Battle of Peterloo, occurred at St. Peter's Field, Manchester, England, on the 16th of August 1819, when cavalry charged into a crowd of 60 to 80,000 gathered at a meeting to demand the reform of parliamentary representation. The end of the Napoleonic Wars in 1815 had resulted in periods of famine and chronic unemployment, exacerbated by the introduction of the first of the Corn Laws. By the beginning of 1819, the pressure generated by poor economic conditions, coupled with the lack of suffrage in northern England, had enhanced the appeal of political radicalism. In response, the Manchester Patriotic Union, a group agitating for parliamentary reform, organised a demonstration to be addressed by the well-known radical orator Henry Hunt. Shortly after the meeting began, local magistrates called on the military to arrest Hunt and several others on the hustings with him, and to disperse the crowd. Cavalry charged into the crowd with sabres drawn, and in the ensuing confusion 15 people were killed, and 400 to 700 were injured, among them many women and even children. The massacre was given the name Peterloo, in ironic comparison to the Battle of Waterloo, which had taken place 4 years earlier. Historian Robert Poole has called the Peterloo Massacre one of the defining moments of its age. In its own time, the London and national papers shared the horror felt in the Manchester region, but Peterloo's immediate effect was to cause the government to crack down on reform with the passing of what became known as the Six Acts. It did also lead directly to the foundation of the Manchester Guardian, now The Guardian, but it had little other effect on the pace of reform. Peterloo is commemorated by a plaque close to the site, which has been criticised as being inadequate. In a survey conducted by The Guardian in 2006, Peterloo came second to the Putney debates as the event from British history that most deserved a proper monument or a memorial. Section 1. Background. Suffrage. In 1819, Lancashire was represented by two Members of Parliament, MPs. Voting was restricted to the adult male owners of freehold land valued at 40 shillings or more, the equivalent of about £80 sterling as of 2008, and votes could only be cast at the county town of Lancaster by a public spoken declaration at the hustings. Constituency boundaries were out of date, and the so-called rotten boroughs had a hugely disproportionate influence on the membership of the Parliament of the United Kingdom compared to the size of their populations. Old Sarum in Wiltshire, with one voter, elected two MPs, as did Dunwich in Suffolk, which by the early 19th century had almost completely disappeared into the sea. The major urban centres of Manchester, Salford, Bolton, Blackburn, Rochdale, Ashton-under-Lyne, Oldham and Stockport, with a combined population of almost 1 million, were represented by either the two county MPs for Lancashire or the two for Cheshire in the case of Stockport. By comparison, more than half of all MPs were elected by a total of just 154 voters. These inequalities in political representation led to calls for reform. Economic conditions. After the end of the Napoleonic Wars in 1815, a brief boom in textile manufacture was followed by periods of chronic economic depression, particularly among textile weavers and spinners. Weavers who could have expected to earn 15 shillings for a six-day week in 1803 saw their wages cut to 5 shillings, or even 4 shillings and sixpence, by 1818. The industrialists, who were cutting wages without offering relief, blamed market forces generated by the aftershocks of the Napoleonic Wars. Exacerbating matters were the Corn Laws, the first of which was passed in 1815, imposing a tax on imports in an effort to protect the price of home-grown grain. The cost of food rose as people were forced to buy the more expensive and lower quality British grain, and periods of famine and chronic unemployment ensued, increasing the desire for political reform, both in Lancashire and in the country at large. By the beginning of 1819, the pressure generated by poor economic conditions was at its peak and had enhanced the appeal of political radicalism among the cotton loom weavers of South Lancashire. In response, coupled with the lack of suffrage in northern England, a great assembly was organised by the Manchester Patriotic Union, a group agitating for parliamentary reform. The secretary of the union, Joseph Johnson, wrote to the well-known radical orator Henry Hunt, asking him to chair a large meeting planned for Manchester on the 2nd of August 1819. In his letter, Johnson wrote, "Nothing but ruin and starvation stare one in the face in the streets of Manchester and the surrounding towns. The state of this district is truly dreadful, and I believe nothing but the greatest exertions can prevent an insurrection. Oh, that you in London were prepared for it." Unknown to either Johnson or Hunt, the letter was intercepted by government spies and copied before being sent on to its destination. The contents were interpreted to mean that an insurrection was being planned, and the government immediately responded by ordering the 15th Hussars to Manchester. The mass public meeting planned for the 2nd of August was delayed until the 9th of August. Announcing the delay, the Manchester Observer reported that the intention of the meeting was to take into consideration the most speedy and effectual mode of obtaining radical reform in the Common House of Parliament, and to consider the propriety of the unrepresented inhabitants of Manchester electing a person to represent them in Parliament. The local magistrates, under the leadership of William Holton, had already been advised by the acting Home Secretary, Henry Hobhouse, that the election of a Member of Parliament without the King's writ was a serious misdemeanour, encouraging them to declare the Assembly illegal. Rehearsals. Although banning the 9th of August meeting had been intended to discourage the Radicals entirely, Hunt and his followers were determined to assemble. A new meeting was organised for the 16th of August, after the Home Secretary, Lord Sidmouth, had written to the magistrates instructing them that it was not the intention to elect an MP that was illegal, but the execution of that intention. The press had frequently mocked previous meetings of working men because of their ragged, dirty appearance and disorganised conduct. The organisers were determined that those attending the meeting at St. Peter's Field would be neatly turned out and would march to the event in good order. Samuel Bamford, a local radical who led the Middleton contingent to the Assembly, wrote that it was deemed expedient that this meeting should be as morally effective as possible, and that it should exhibit a spectacle such as had never before been witnessed in England. Instructions were given to the various committees forming the contingents that cleanliness, sobriety, order and peace, and a prohibition of all weapons of offence or defence were to be observed throughout the demonstration. Each contingent was drilled and rehearsed in the fields of the towns around Manchester, further adding to the concerns of the authorities. One spy reported that 700 men drilled at Tandle Hill, as well as any army regiment would. A royal proclamation forbidding the practice of drilling was posted in Manchester on the 3rd of August. Section 2. Assembly. Preparations. St. Peter's Field was a croft, an open piece of land, alongside Mount Street, which was being cleared to enable the last section of Peter Street to be constructed. Piles of brushwood had been placed at the end of the field nearest to the Friends Meeting House, but the remainder of the field was clear. Thomas Worrell, Manchester's assistant surveyor of paving, arrived to inspect the field at 7 a.m. His job was to remove anything that might be used as a weapon, and he duly had about a quarter of a load of stones carted away. Monday the 16th of August 1819 was a hot summer's day with a cloudless blue sky. The fine weather almost certainly increased the size of the crowd significantly. Marching from the outer townships in the cold and rain would have been a much less attractive prospect. The Manchester magistrates met at 9 a.m. to breakfast at the Star Inn on Deansgate and to consider what action they should take on Henry Hunt's arrival at the meeting. By 10:30 a.m. they had come to no conclusions and moved to a house on the southeastern corner of St. Peter's Field, from where they planned to observe the meeting. They were concerned that it would end in a riot or even a rebellion, and had arranged for a substantial number of regular troops and militia yeomanry to be deployed. The military presence comprised 600 men of the 15th Hussars, several hundred infantry men, a Royal Horse Artillery unit with 2 6-pounder guns, 2.7 kilograms, 400 men of the Cheshire Yeomanry, 400 special constables, and 120 cavalry of the Manchester and Salford Yeomanry, relatively inexperienced militia recruited from among local shopkeepers and tradesmen, the most numerous of which were publicans. The Manchester Yeomanry were variously described as younger members of the Tory party in arms, and as hot-headed young men who had volunteered into that service from their intense hatred of radicalism. The British army in the north was under the overall command of General Sir John Byng. When he had initially learned that the meeting was scheduled for the 2nd of August, he had written to the Home Office stating that he hoped the Manchester magistrates would show firmness on the day. "I will be prepared to go there, and will have in that neighbourhood, that is, within an easy day's march, 8 squadron of cavalry, 18 companies of infantry, and the guns. I am sure I can add to the yeomanry, if requisite. I hope, therefore, the civil authorities will not be deterred from doing their duty." The revised meeting date of the 16th of August, however, coincided with the horse races at York, a fashionable event at which Byng had entries in 2 races. He once again wrote to the Home Office, saying that although he would still be prepared to be in command in Manchester on the day of the meeting if it was thought really necessary, he had absolute confidence in his deputy commandant, Lieutenant Colonel Guy Lestrange. Contingents sent to St. Peter's Field. See the map in the article for further details. Contingents were sent from Altrincham, Ashton-under-Lyne, Atherton, Bolton, Bury, Chadderton, Crompton, Eccles, Failsworth, G. Cross, Haywood, Earlham, Lees, Lee, Middleton, Mossley, Oldham, Rochdale, Royton, Saddleworth, Salford, Stalybridge, Stretford, Stockport, Ermston, West Horton, Whitefield, and Wigan. The Ashton-under-Lyne contingent was 2,000. The Bury contingent was 3,000. The Middleton contingent was 3,000. The Oldham contingent was between 6,000 and 10,000. The Rochdale contingent was 3,000, and the Stockport contingent was between 1,500 and 5,000. Meeting. The crowd that gathered in St. Peter's Field arrived in disciplined and organised contingents. Each village or chapelry was given a time and a place to meet, from where its members were to proceed to assembly points in the larger towns or townships, and from there on to Manchester. Contingents were sent from all around the region, the largest and best dressed of which was a group of 10,000 who had travelled from Oldham Green, comprising people from Oldham, Royton, which included a sizeable female section, Crompton, Lees, Saddleworth, and Mossley. Other sizeable contingents marched from Middleton and Rochdale, 6,000 strong, and Stockport, 1,500 to 5,000 strong. Reports of the size of the crowd at the meeting vary substantially. Contemporaries estimated it from 30,000 to as many as 150,000. Modern estimates are 60,000 to 80,000. Scholar Joyce Marlowe describes the event as the most numerous meeting that ever took place in Great Britain, and elaborates that the generally accepted figure of 60,000 would have been 6% of the population of Lancashire, or half the population of the immediate area around Manchester. The assembly was intended by its organisers and participants to be a peaceful meeting. Henry Hunt had exhorted everyone attending to come armed with no other weapon but that of a self-approving conscience, and many were wearing their Sunday best clothes. Samuel Bamford recounts the following incident, which occurred as the Middleton contingent reached the outskirts of Manchester. "On the bank of an open field on our left, I perceived a gentleman observing us attentively. He beckoned me, and I went to him. He was one of my late employers. He took my hand, and rather concernedly, but kindly, said he hoped no harm was intended by all those people who were coming in. I said I would pledge my life for their entire peaceableness. I asked him to notice them. Did they look like persons wishing to outrage the law? Were they not, on the contrary, evidently heads of decent working families, or members of such families? No, no, I said, my dear sir and old respected master, if any wrong or violence take place, they will be committed by men of a different stamp from these. He said he was very glad to hear me say so. He was happy he had seen me, and gratified by the manner in which I had expressed myself. I asked, did he think we should be interrupted at the meeting? He said he did not believe we should. Then, I replied, all will be well. and shaking hands with mutual good wishes, I left him and took my station as before. Although some observers, like the Reverend W. R. Hay, chairman of the Salford Quarter Sessions, claimed that the active part of the meeting may be said to have come in wholly from the country, others, such as John Shuttleworth, a local cotton manufacturer, estimated that most were from Manchester, a view that would subsequently be supported by the casualty lists. Of the casualties whose residence was recorded, 61% lived within a 3-mile radius of the centre of Manchester. Some groups carried banners with texts like No Corn Laws, Annual Parliaments, Universal Suffrage, and Vote by Ballot. The only banner known to have survived is in Middleton Public Library. It was carried by Thomas Redford, who was injured by a yeomanry sabre. Made of green silk embossed with gold lettering, one side of the banner is inscribed Liberty and Fraternity, and the other Unity and Strength. At about noon, several hundred special constables were led onto the field. They formed two lines in the crowd, a few yards apart, in an attempt to form a corridor through the crowd between the house where the magistrates were watching and the hustings, two wagons lashed together. Believing that this might be intended as the route by which the magistrates would later send their representatives to arrest the speakers, some members of the crowd pushed the wagons away from the constables and pressed around the hustings to form a human barrier. Hunt's carriage arrived at the meeting shortly after 1 p.m, and he made his way to the hustings. Alongside Hunt on the speaker's stand were John Knight, a cotton manufacturer and reformer, Joseph Johnson, the organiser of the meeting, John Thacker Saxton, managing editor of the Manchester Observer, the publisher Richard Carlyle, and George Swift, reformer and shoemaker. There were also a number of reporters, including John Tyas of the Times, John Smith of the Liverpool Echo, and Edward Baines Jr., the son of the editor of the Leeds Mercury. By this time, St. Peter's Field, an area of 14,000 square yards, 11,706 square metres, was packed with tens of thousands of men, women and children. The crowd around the speakers was so dense that their hats seemed to touch. Large groups of curious spectators gathered on the outskirts of the crowd. The rest of Manchester was like a ghost town. The streets and shops were empty. Section 3. Charge. William Hulton, the chairman of the magistrates watching from the house on the edge of St. Peter's Field, saw the enthusiastic reception that Hunt received on his arrival at the assembly, and it encouraged him to action. He issued an arrest warrant for Henry Hunt, Joseph Johnson, John Knight, and James Morehouse. On being handed the warrant, the chief constable, Jonathan Andrews, offered his opinion that the press of the crowd surrounding the hustings would make military assistance necessary for its execution. Hulton then wrote two letters, one to Major Thomas Trafford, the commanding officer of the Manchester Yeomanry, and the other to the overall military commander in Manchester, Lieutenant Colonel Guy Lestrange. The contents of both notes were similar. Sir, as chairman of the Select Committee of Magistrates, I request you to proceed immediately to No. 6 Mount Street, where the magistrates are assembled. They consider the civil power wholly inadequate to preserve the peace. I have the honour, etc., William Hulton. Letter sent by William Hulton to Major Trafford, of the Manchester Yeomanry. The notes were handed to two horsemen who were standing by. The Manchester Yeomanry were stationed just a short distance away in Portland Street, and so received their note first. The Yeomanry immediately drew their swords and galloped towards St. Peter's Field. One trooper, in a frantic attempt to catch up, knocked down a woman in Cooper Street, causing the death of her child when he was thrown from her arms. 2-year-old William Fildes was the first casualty of Peterloo. 60 cavalrymen of the Manchester Yeomanry, led by Captain Hugh Hornby Burley, a local factory owner, arrived at the house from where the magistrates were watching. Some reports allege that the yeomanry were drunk. Andrews, the chief constable, instructed Burley that he had an arrest warrant which he needed assistance to execute. Burley was asked to take his cavalry to the hustings to allow the speakers to be removed. It was by then about 1:40 p.m. The route towards the hustings, between the special constables, was narrow, and as the inexperienced horses were thrust further and further into the crowd, they reared and plunged as people tried to get out of their way. The arrest warrant had been given to the deputy constable, Joseph Nadin, who followed behind the yeomanry. As the cavalry pushed towards the speaker's stand, they became stuck in the crowd, and in panic started to hack about them with their sabres. On his arrival at the stand, Nadin arrested Hunt, Johnson, and a number of others, including John Tyas, the reporter from the Times. According to Tyas, the yeomanry's progress through the crowd had provoked a hail of bricks and stones and caused them to lose all command of temper. Their mission to execute the arrest warrant having been achieved, they then set about destroying the banners and flags carried by the crowd. From his vantage point, William Holton perceived the unfolding events as an assault on the yeomanry, and on Lestrange's arrival at 1:50 p.m, at the head of his hussars, he ordered them into the field to disperse the crowd, with the words, "Good God, sir, don't you see they are attacking the yeomanry? Disperse the meeting." The 15th Hussars formed themselves into a line stretching across the eastern end of St. Peter's Field and charged into the crowd. At about the same time, the Cheshire Yeomanry charged from the southern edge of the field. At first, the crowd had some difficulty in dispersing, as the main exit route into Peter Street was blocked by the 88th Infantry Regiment, standing with bayonets fixed. One officer of the 15th Hussars was heard trying to restrain the by now out-of-control Manchester Yeomanry, who were cutting at everyone they could reach. "For shame, for shame! Gentlemen, forbear, forbear! The people cannot get away." However, within 10 minutes, the crowd had been dispersed, at the cost of 11 dead and over 600 injured. Only the wounded, their helpers, and the dead were left behind. A woman living nearby said she saw a very great deal of blood. For some time afterwards, there was rioting in the streets, most seriously at New Cross, where troops fired on a crowd attacking a shop belonging to someone rumoured to have taken one of the women reformers' flags as a souvenir. Peace was not restored in Manchester until the next morning, and in Stockport and Macclesfield, rioting continued on the 17th. There was also a major riot in Oldham that day, during which one person was shot and wounded. Section 4. Victims. The exact number of those killed and injured at Peterloo has never been established with certainty. Sources claim 11 to 15 killed and 400 to 700 injured. The Manchester Relief Committee, a body set up to provide relief for the victims of Peterloo, gave the number of injured as 420, while radical sources listed 500. The true number is difficult to estimate, as many of the wounded hid their injuries for fear of retribution by the authorities. Three of William Marsh's six children worked in the factory belonging to Captain Hugh Burley of the Manchester Yeomanry and lost their jobs because their father had attended the meeting. James Lees was admitted to Manchester Infirmary with two severe sabre wounds to the head, but was refused treatment and sent home after refusing to confess to the surgeon that he had had enough of Manchester meetings. A particular feature of the meeting at Peterloo was the number of women present. Female reform societies had been formed in northwest England during June and July 1819, the first in Britain. Many of them were dressed distinctively in white, and some formed all-female contingents, carrying their own flags. Of the 654 recorded casualties, at least 168 were women, four of whom died either at St. Peter's Field or later as a result of their wounds. It has been estimated that less than 12% of the crowd was made up of females, suggesting that women were at significantly greater risk of injury than men by a factor of almost 3 to 1. Richard Carlyle claimed that the women were especially targeted, a view apparently supported by the large number who suffered from wounds caused by weapons. 11 of the fatalities listed here occurred on St. Peter's Field. Some, like John Lees of Oldham, died later of their wounds, and others, like Joshua Whitworth, were killed in the rioting that followed the crowd's dispersal from the field. Fatalities resulting from Peterloo. Name: John Ashton. Abode: Cowhill, Oldham. Date of death, if reported, 16th of August. Cause: sabred and trampled on by crowd. Notes: carried the black flag of the Saddleworth, Lees and Mossley Union, inscribed, "Taxation without representation is unjust and tyrannical. No corn laws." The inquest jury returned a verdict of accidental death. His son, Samuel, received 20 shillings in relief. Name: John Ashworth. Abode: Bull's Head, Manchester. Date of death not recorded. Cause, sabred and trampled. Ashworth was a special constable, presumably attacked unintentionally by the cavalry. Name, William Bradshaw. Abode, Lily Hill, Bury. Date of death not recorded. Cause, shot by musket. Name, Thomas Buckley. Abode, Bear Trees, Chadderton. Date of death, not recorded. Cause, sabred and stabbed by bayonet. Name, Robert Campbell. Abode, Miller Street, Salford. Date of death, 18th of August. Cause, killed by a mob in Newton Lane. Campbell was a special constable. Name, James Crompton. Abode, Barton-upon-Irwell. Date of death, not recorded. Cause, trampled on by the cavalry. Buried 1st of September. Name, Edmund Dawson. Abode, Saddleworth. Date of death, not recorded. Cause, died of sabre wounds at the Manchester Royal Infirmary. Name, William Dawson. Abode, Saddleworth. Date of death, not recorded. Cause, sabred, crushed, and killed on the spot. Name, Margaret Downs. Abode, Manchester. Date of death, not recorded. Cause, sabred. Name, William Evans. Abode, Hume. Date of death, not recorded. Cause, trampled by cavalry. Evans was a special constable. Name, William Fildes. Abode, Kennedy Street, Manchester. Date of death, 16th of August. Cause, ridden over by cavalry. 2 years old, he was the first victim of the massacre. His mother was carrying him across the road when she was struck by a trooper of the Manchester Yeomanry galloping towards St. Peter's Field. Name, Mary Hayes. Abode, Oxford Road, Manchester. Date of death, 17th of December. Cause, ridden over by cavalry. Mother of 6 children and pregnant at the time of the meeting. Disabled and suffering from almost daily fits following her injuries, the premature birth of her 7-month-old child resulted in her death. Name, Sarah Jones. Abode, 96 Silt Street, Salford. Date of death, not recorded. No cause given by Marlowe, but listed as bruised in the head by Frau. Mother of 7 children, beaten on the head by a special constable's truncheon. Name, John Lees. Abode, Oldham. Date of death, 9th of September. Cause, sabred. Lees was an ex-soldier who had fought in the Battle of Waterloo. Name, Arthur Neal. Abode, Pigeon Street, Manchester. Date of death, not recorded. Cause, inwardly crushed. Name, Martha Partington. Abode, Eccles. Date of death, not recorded. Cause, thrown into a cellar and killed on the spot. Name, John Rhodes. Abode, Pitts, Hopwood. Date of death, 18th or 19th of November. Cause, sabre wound to the head. Rhodes's body was dissected by order of magistrates wishing to prove his death was not a result of Peterloo. The coroner's inquest found that he had died from natural causes. Name, Joshua Whitworth. Abode, not recorded. Date of death, 20th of August. Cause, shot at New Cross. In her 1969 book, The Peterloo Massacre, Joyce Marlowe suggests that William and Edmund Dawson of Saddleworth may have been the same individual. Section 5. Reaction and Aftermath. Public. The Peterloo Massacre has been called one of the defining moments of its age. Many of those present at the massacre, including local masters, employers and owners, were horrified by the carnage. One of the casualties, Oldham cloth worker and ex-soldier John Lees, who died from his wounds on the 7th of September, had been present at the Battle of Waterloo. Shortly before his death, he said to a friend that he had never been in such danger as at Peterloo. At Waterloo, there was man to man, but there it was downright murder. When news of the massacre began to spread, the population of Manchester and surrounding districts were horrified and outraged. This was the first public meeting at which journalists from a number of important, distant newspapers were present, and within a day or so of the event, accounts were published as far away as London, Leeds and Liverpool. The London and national papers shared the horror felt in the Manchester region, and the feeling of indignation throughout the country became intense. The name Peterloo was coined immediately by the radical Manchester Observer, combining the name of the meeting place, St. Peter's Field, with the Battle of Waterloo, fought 4 years earlier. The poet Percy Bysshe Shelley was living in Italy at the time, and did not hear of the massacre until the 5th of September. He immediately wrote a poem entitled The Mask of Anarchy, subtitled Written on the Occasion of the Massacre at Manchester, and sent it for publication in the radical periodical The Examiner. However, due to restrictions on the radical press, the poem was not published until 1832. Many commemorative items, such as plates, jugs, handkerchiefs, and medals, were produced, all with the iconic image of Peterloo, cavalrymen with swords drawn, riding along and slashing at defenceless women and girls. Political. The immediate effect of Peterloo was a crackdown on reform. Hunt and eight others were tried at York Assizes on the 16th of March 1820, charged with sedition. After a two-week trial, five of the 10 defendants were found guilty. Hunt was sentenced to 30 months in Ilchester Jail, Bamford, Johnson and Healy were given 1 year each, and Knight was jailed for 2 years on a subsequent charge. A test case was brought against four members of the Manchester Yeomanry at Lancaster Assizes on the 4th of April 1822. Captain Burley, Captain Withington, Trumpeter Meyer, and Private Oliver. All were acquitted, as the court ruled that their actions had been justified to disperse an illegal gathering. The government declared its support for the actions taken by the magistrates and the army. The Manchester magistrates held a supposedly public meeting on the 19th of August, so that resolutions supporting the action they had taken 3 days before could be published. Archibald Prentice, a radical manufacturer, later to become editor of the Manchester Times, organised a petition of protest against the violence at St. Peter's Field and the validity of the magistrates' meeting. Within a few days, it had collected 4,800 signatures. Nevertheless, the Home Secretary, Lord Sidmouth, on the 27th of August, conveyed to the magistrates the thanks of the Prince Regent for their action in the preservation of the public peace. That public exoneration was met with fierce anger and criticism. During a debate in Parliament, Robert Wedderburn declared, "The Prince is a fool with his wonderful letters of thanks. What is the Prince Regent or King to us? We want no king. He is no use to us." In an open letter, Richard Carlyle said, "Unless the Prince calls his ministers to account and relieved his people, he would surely be deposed and make them all Republicans, despite all adherence to ancient and established institutions." For a few months following Peterloo, it seemed to the authorities that the country was heading towards an armed rebellion. Encouraging them in that belief were two abortive uprisings in Huddersfield and Burnley during the autumn of 1819, and the discovery and foiling of the Cato Street conspiracy to blow up the cabinet that winter. By the end of the year, the government had introduced legislation, later known as the Six Acts, to suppress radical meetings and publications, and by the end of 1820, every significant working-class radical reformer was in jail. Civil liberties had declined to an even lower level than they were before Peterloo. Historian Robert Reed has written that it is not fanciful to compare the restricted freedoms of the British worker in the post-Peterloo period in the early 19th century with those of the black South African in the post-Sharpeville period of the late 20th century. One direct consequence of Peterloo was the foundation of the Manchester Guardian newspaper in 1821 by a group of nonconformist Manchester businessmen headed by John Edward Taylor, a witness to the massacre. The prospectus announcing the new publication proclaimed that it would zealously enforce the principles of civil and religious liberty, warmly advocate the cause of reform, endeavour to assist in the diffusion of just principles of political economy, and support, without reference to the party from which they emanate, all serviceable measures. Events such as the Pentridge Rising, the March of the Blanketeers, and the Spar Fields Meeting all serve to indicate the breadth, diversity, and widespread geographical scale of the demand for economic and political reform at the time. Peterloo had no effect on the speed of reform, but in due course all but one of the reformers' demands, annual parliaments, were met. Following the Great Reform Act of 1832, the newly created Manchester Parliamentary Borough elected its first two MPs. Five candidates, including William Cobbett, stood, and the Whigs, Charles Poulett Thomson and Mark Phillips, were elected. Manchester became a municipal borough in 1837, and what remained of the manorial rights was subsequently purchased by the Borough Council. Section 6. Commemoration. The Free Trade Hall, home of the Anti-Corn Law League, was built partly as a cenotaph raised on the shades of the victims of Peterloo. Until 2007, the massacre was commemorated by a blue plaque on the wall of the present building, the third to occupy the site, now the Radisson Hotel. It was regarded as a less-than-appropriate memorial because it underreported the incident as a dispersal and the deaths were omitted completely. In a 2006 survey conducted by The Guardian, Peterloo came second to St Mary's Church, Putney, the venue for the Putney debates, as the event from British history that most deserved a proper monument. A Peterloo Massacre Memorial campaign was set up to lobby for a more prominent monument to an event that has been described as Manchester's Tiananmen Square. In 2007, Manchester City Council replaced the original blue plaque with a red one, giving a more complete account of the events of 1819. It was unveiled on the 10th of December 2007 by the Lord Mayor of Manchester, Councillor Glyn Evans. Under the heading St Peter's Fields, the Peterloo Massacre, the new plaque reads, On August the 16th, 1819, a peaceful rally of 60,000 pro-democracy reformers, men, women and children, was attacked by armed cavalry, resulting in 15 deaths and over 600 injuries. In 1968, the Trades Union Congress commissioned British composer Sir Malcolm Arnold to write the Peterloo Overture in celebration of its centenary. Other 20th century musical commemorations include Ned Ludd Part 5 on electric folk group Steel Eye Span's album Bloody Men, and Rochdale rock band Tractor's suite of five songs written and recorded in 1973, later included on their 1992 release Worst Enemies. Section 7. See also. See also the following related articles. Bolton Massacre, an episode in the English Civil War at Bolton, and Unreformed House of Commons. This sound file and all text in the article are licensed under the GNU Free Documentation License, available at www.gnu.org/copyleft/fdl.html.